If you've been inspired by the recent advances in 3D printing, then you're probably a fan of invention and innovation. This seventh episode of Spiral Marketing is a unique window into the newly leveled world of makers. From the do-it-yourself trend to the Internet of Things, Arduino circuits, kids that code, and WordPress to open source innovation, the next industrial revolution is knocking at the door. And if you feel like you missed the boat, then as you listen to this episode, imagine how you could just start. Because there's more opportunity to create and build your ideas than ever before. Go where there is no path and leave a trail. Ralph Waldo Emerson.
What is the DNA of business marketing? How do we market ourselves now and in the future? Brand communications is evolving. Are you? Let's explore together. Spiral upwards. This is Spiral Marketing.
Jim Newton is the chairman and founder of TechShop, which is a maker space with 8 locations. In case you're not familiar, the concept of a maker space is pretty simple. It's just a physical place with equipment and the facilities for people to go and build things. Makerspaces evolved from the science, technology, engineering, math, or STEM education community, and at some point merged into a collective community of inventors, hackers, artists, entrepreneurs, engineers, and other crafty folks. These places are a mecca for DIY people who don't have the equipment they need in their garages. Jim is an uber DIYer and lifelong maker. A serial entrepreneur, Jim holds several design patents and created TechShop because he needed a place to build his own inventions. Before founding TechShop, Jim was a BattleBots competitor and former full-time science advisor on the Discovery Channel's hit show MythBusters. Jim spends much of his time on-site at TechShop and thoroughly enjoys helping TechShop members with their projects. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
Could you tell us a bit about the dream behind makerspaces and the maker movement overall?
Yeah, you know, I think the real power is that everybody has ideas of things that they want to make. Everybody does. Even if you ask someone, do you have an idea of something you want to make? They'll say no, but then you can kind of dig it out of them after a while. And once you do, they'll tell you all about it. And it's very clear after they start talking about it that they've thought about it a long time. The problem is that people don't have anywhere to go and actually make things. Very few people have workshops anymore. Maybe their dad had a workshop, but maybe the dad's not around anymore, you know, got too old and passed away or got rid of all the tools. And so makerspaces really serve an important role in giving people access to those tools. Now, you know, what makerspaces really need to do more, I think, is get people to be brave enough, kind of coax people out of this fear of making whatever it is they want to make and actually come in and make it.
Great. Maybe we should give a little bit of a clearer picture of what a makerspace looks like. So do you want to talk a little bit about the equipment?
Yeah, sure. So as far as the layout and the concept of a makerspace, the easiest way to describe it is imagine a membership-based gym that you've been to before. And instead of exercise equipment, you've got all the tools and machines there available so you can use them to make things. That's basically what a makerspace is. Now, makerspaces range anywhere from a couple of guys that decided to pool their personal tools and rent a little space in an R&D strip complex, all the way to tech shops, the biggest, you know, of the footprints of makerspaces. You know, each one's about 18 to 20,000 square feet, full-time staff of about 20 people, about $1 million worth of tools and equipment, you know, really laid out in a professional, a mainstream kind of way. It's not to say that other kinds of makerspaces are any, I would love to just hang out in one of these neighborhood makerspaces, and I love them. But we've just decided to go kind of the commercial side. So you go into pretty much every makerspace is going to have stuff like commercial consumer level 3D printer, like a MakerBot, something like that. They're going to have probably a laser cutter, and they're probably going to have some soldering and electronics equipment. and then, you know, tables to work on, stuff like that. That's kind of the lowest common denominator. Then you go up to a place like, you know, a tech shop that has everything. It has a full machine shop with milling machines and lathes and all the accessories to go with that. CNC mills, sheet metal equipment for bending and cutting and punching and stamping, welding equipment for welding any kind of material together. Most of our locations, all of them except our very first one, has a thing called a water jet cutter. A water jet cutter is a machine that's about 6 by 10 feet in size, and it uses a high pressure water stream with garnet, like sandpaper grit. And it can cut up to 6 inches thick of any material on the planet. So that's something that most makerspaces don't have because it's like a $200,000 machine. we have, you know, complete woodworking shop, complete with, you know, all the stuff that you'd expect, table saws and planers and joiners and shop bot CNC routers. So you can take your two-dimensional or three-dimensional design, put it in the computer, and it will cut all the wood out for you. You know, laser cutters, we have in San Francisco, we have 6 laser cutters. So it's, you know, quite a large facility. Electronics. We've just partnered with National Instruments, so we have all of their new, really nice electronics test equipment and development stuff there. 3D printers, sewing equipment. We have a full sewing lab at Tech Shop. Basically, anything that you need pretty much to build almost anything you can think of. Not everything, but almost everything.
Right. I don't talk about it much on the show, but I've been interested in inventing new product design since I was really little. And I know coming out of a tech shop, I felt like a kid in a candy store, you know, just if you had an idea for a car accessory. There's a room in there where you could literally build car parts. I mean, if not a whole car.
Yeah, that's true.
Awesome. Well, where does your passion for developing makerspaces stem from?
I mean, the reason I started Tech Shop was actually kind of a selfish endeavor, I have to say, because, you know, like in your intro, you said I'm a lifelong maker. Well, I am. I've been making since I was a little tiny kid. My dad gave me access to his workshop and showed me how to weld with an oxyacetylene gas torch when I was pretty young, probably 5 or 6 years old.
Wow.
And something really magical happened about around that time is my dad took a 1961 Volkswagen Bug that was actually, sadly, thinking back on it, it was actually in really good condition. And that car would be worth quite a bit of money today. But he pulled it up into our carport of our house and completely took it apart and built a fiberglass dune buggy out of the frame and engine and all that. You know, wired everything up, cut and welded steel and drilled holes in the fiberglass and all this stuff. And I saw that was kind of my first introduction to, wow, you can actually make stuff. Humans can actually make really big, cool stuff. And I think that gave me the bug to want to pursue that. So I dropped out of college because I had this great job offer. A lot of people probably get that kind of situation. I'm glad I took it because it was exactly the job I was going to school to try to get. And here it was offered to me a semester before I was done. So I bailed, took that, worked that job for 4 years. And that taught me that I don't want to ever work for anyone else again. Sorry. I apologize if my former boss is watching this, but so I started a software development company in 1990, started on that path of entrepreneurism, starting my own businesses. Then when the dot-com bomb hit in 2001, I kind of shifted the business a little bit and tried to look around to see what else I could do. So I started actually making things. I made an 8-wheel tank replica for a friend of mine. He paid me to do it. And I was like, wow, that's really fun. It's like getting back welding and bending metal and all that. So that was a lot of fun. Then I started teaching. I went on BattleBots, and that was fun because you build these 220-pound insanity machines that are supposed to go and destroy other insanity machines. It's pretty intense. And so I had fun with doing that for a couple of years, really working with my hands and also doing the electronics, the mechanical design. So that's very intellectual. Then I started teaching a class at the local college, showing people how to make BattleBots. And I just did that so I could get access to the shop up there because I didn't have access to really much in the way of tools other than what I had in the garage, which was just basically like, you know, a drill press, a grinder, and a welder. And that was like it. So I wanted access to a million machines and lathes and, you know, sheet metal equipment, things like that, that I didn't have access to. Then I got on a Mythbusters show, crashed that show, got on there as the science advisor for a year. I was working, you know, actually on site full time for a year. So it was pretty amazing. But then after I got done with Mythbusters and got done with teaching the BattleBots class at the college, suddenly I was without tools because I was using the Mythbusters shop tools as well. That was one of the benefits of being able to work there is I could, after work, I could stay and use all the equipment. Well, once I was done with those, I didn't have any equipment, but now I was in this like full speed maker mode in my mind. And I was like really enjoying making things. I didn't have access to any of the tools that I had gotten used to. So I decided, okay, I'm probably going to need to build my own shop now because I need all those pieces of equipment. I want the sheet metal stuff. I want the punch. I want the mill and the lathe and the computer controlled equipment. I want to be able to use all that stuff. And then, you know, I walked through in my mind, okay, well, that means I got to rent a space. I got to buy insurance. I got to buy all the pieces of equipment. I got to pay for utilities. Man, how am I going to pay for this? I'm going to end up having to do prototype and fabrication work for customers to pay the bills to keep the shop open. That's not what I want to do. I just wanted the tools so I could goof around and have fun, you know, pursue my, you know, all these different projects that I wanted to work on. And so that was the spark right there. And that's when I thought, well, what? And because there were no maker spaces in 2005 when I started putting this together. I couldn't just go, oh, just do a makerspace. Didn't exist. So I thought, what if I build a really nice shop? I design it for multiple people, not just for me. And I charge admission to let people come in and use it. Then I get to use it for free. And I don't have to do prototype work to pay the bills. So that's what drove it.
That's so cool.
And it was originally going to just be one location, the one location here in Menlo Park in the Bay Area. It was just going to be basically a lifestyle business. As long as it paid the bills and broke even and provided a little income for me, that would be nice. So I didn't have to go out and get another job. That's pretty much all I was looking for. And then, you know, of course, it became popular. People loved the idea, the concept of a makerspace. And here we are with 8 locations and almost 7,000 active members across the country.
That's a great story. You dreamed up. How would you have your perfect space?
It was fun to do it that way because I realized I wasn't going to have to limit the shop to just the stuff I could afford and I could, you know, justify.
Right.
I could go nuts, right? Anything I can put in there is going to make the space more attractive to potential members. So it's a better value for them. So the more stuff I add, the more successful it's going to be. And I get to play with all the stuff for free.
That's excellent. I meant to ask you, do you remember the very first thing that you made as a kid?
Probably, yeah. I don't know. I don't think it exists anymore. I think my mom had it for a long time or my dad had it or somewhere because I remember seeing it and, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years ago and thinking that's pretty dumb. But now I kind of wish I had it. It was from my dad for Father's Day or his birthday or something. And it was this kind of I don't even know how to describe it. It was a nail dispenser. So you'd put like these big nails that were like, you know, I don't know, they were probably like 6-inch nails that I grabbed out of his workshop. And it had a little hopper and you cranked it and it would actually pick up one nail at a time and kind of present it to you. And it was all made out of like wood and dowels and, you know, all kind of nailed together. And it was horrible, but it actually worked. It actually would pick up nails and... That's the earliest thing. And I was probably 4 or 5.
Yeah, that's cute. That's a little assembly line to give your dad his nails.
Yeah.
All right. Well, how do you feel like your past led you to becoming the chairman? You know, I think some people might have been comfortable saying, all right, well, now this is becoming a big business and I'm going to step back and let the machine do its thing.
No, you're exactly right. That's exactly how it happened. From the time we opened the first location, it was me and my wife. My wife was doing the books and doing the front desk stuff. A handful of employees running the shop. After we opened in October of 2006. And then in about June or July, we got an article in Inc. magazine, like with photos and everything. So again, the founder of Kinko's, a guy named Paul Orfila, actually was commenting on our business model, you know, favorably. And it's like, my head exploded at that point. It's like, okay, this might be a bit bigger than I thought it was. You know, why is this little shop that I built in Inc. magazine? That's insane. And we started getting a lot of inquiries for franchising. And that's not something I really never thought about, you know, multiple locations of Tech Shop in the beginning. But because of the pressure from the article and all that, I had to really decide, is this just going to be a lifestyle business, this one little location for me? Or am I going to take advantage of what's being handed to me here, the opportunity to open multiple locations and serve more people than I can just in this local area? So we probably had 300 members at that point at this first location, which I thought was awesome. I remember we did $250,000 in sales the first year. I thought, oh my God, that's amazing. You know?
Yeah.
Just that blew my mind. But I spent a couple of months really kind of soul searching to decide, should I expand this or should I just keep it the way it is? And asked a lot of people for their advice, looking at different structures to use, whether it's franchising or not, or this or that. And so I decided, obviously, we have to expand. The first thing I did, though, was I realized that I probably didn't have the business experience or knowledge that I needed to be able to build a multi-location facility, you know, a retail kind of a business, because I had never done that before.
I think anyone would need a team with that level of complexity.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, it's like, I don't want to screw this up, right? I need to really do it. So I started hiring a team. The first person that I hired was our current CEO, Mark Hatch. And that's a whole story in itself about how we met and how that all happened. But, you know, I started putting a team together because I realized this is a pretty big deal. Anyway, so I tend to be a control freak. Of course, I hired him after about, I guess, 6 months or a year or something. He became the CEO. So I was kind of making sure that he had what he needed. And he did. He had exactly what we needed. His background was he was in charge of all the computer services at every Kinko's across the United States.
Wow.
So all the computers, all the printers, all the, like when you go in, all the software, when you go in and use the computers to like run your new little graphic design business, because you can't afford to buy your own computers and software, and you go to Kinko's, that there were thousands of little graphic design companies launched at Kinko's because of that model. And so Mark had the exact experience I needed to do something like this, right? This is exactly the same kind of thing. It's renting this equipment out so people can amplify their abilities and be effective. So he did great. We really started opening locations and doing big partnership deals with big companies. And really, he's been really fantastic. But something that I realized, because I'm a control freak, I really needed to push myself to let go. And you would think that being chairman is not letting go. Well, it's letting go of all the day-to-day stuff. And it's taken me about 3 years to really trust the team. Not that I didn't trust them before. It was just like, I always thought I could do everything better than anyone else. And I've had to really train myself to let go and let the team that I've hired and that I trust run the company. And they do a fantastic job. And it's great. You know, and there's situations where I say, wow, I wouldn't do it that way, you know, or some situation comes up and I know exactly how I'm going to handle it. And I will start to pipe up and I think, no, I'll let the team handle it. You know, I know they can handle it. It's not going to be maybe the way that I would have done it, but maybe that's better, you know? So I think any founder of a company should strive to be the chairman and founder. It's the ultimate title. Because you still have control of everything. You could still fire the CEO or anybody you need to fire, but their job is to do all the day-to-day stuff, all the really important stuff. And you get to focus on the strategic stuff, the visionary kind of stuff, and let them handle that growth. So I love it. It's just perfect for me.
That's interesting. Well, I'm glad that you brought that up because you're touching on leadership. And really, this is a show that it relates directly to marketing. And I try to tie in leadership as often as possible because I think it's just absolutely relevant. I wanted to touch base regarding the 3D printing side. So this year, an independent film came out about the 3D printing side of the maker movement called Print the Legend. 3D printing aside, there was a big focus on the leaders building the companies, the new opportunity for innovation, opening the door for new entrepreneurs and inventors to step up and build amazing companies. What kind of leadership patterns are you seeing in the makerspace community?
I think the maker movement, I sort of said this before, but I think the maker movement, just really what it does is it amplifies people's current abilities and their desires and their passions. So I think if someone has any inkling of being a leader, they want to start their own company or start an organization or whatever, I think this can sort of give them that push to do it, and having the resources to do it amplifies their ability. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
I see a lot of people starting companies and doing things like Kickstarter projects, Indiegogo projects, that where, you know, they had probably never done that before. They'd probably never organized something like that and actually run something like that because it was too hard before. This really does make it a lot easier. You can research things, you can build prototypes. Yeah, I'm looking over. I've got my 3D printer on this side, and I've got my little other mill, little desktop mill over here on the other side. And with the design software and just basic abilities, I can look stuff up. I can research it. I can form a company. I can go to something like LegalZoom or a local attorney for pretty cheap. I can form a corporation. Anybody can do this now, and it's pretty cool. I guess what I'm saying is I think that it allows people that would not have been able to be leaders in the past. Maybe they might not have been able to do it. Now they can actually do it.
Love to talk a little bit about what success looks like. Have you seen any patterns for success in the makerspace with new people starting businesses and just general patterns of success?
Oh, yeah. Well, we have almost 7,000 members, and a huge number of them are doing commercial projects that are actually doing really well. There's things like Square. Square was developed at Tech Shop.
Wow.
You know, the little credit card reader thing. I don't know. I won't go into all the success stories, but just at our location, just literally hundreds of Kickstarter and Indiegogo projects that were done at Tech Shop. And imagine how many are done at other makerspaces too.
Right. Do you have any favorite stories?
Yeah, there's one in particular that it's a guy named David Lang. Are you familiar with his story?
I'm not.
So he has a book called Zero to Maker, and he literally came into Tech Shop. I think he had just the idea for this submersible drone, basically like a remote control submersible camera platform for exploring caves and, you know, water caves and lakes and things like that.
Very cool.
And he came into Tech Shop. He knew nothing about making. He had never made anything in his entire life. You know, fast forward, he goes through, he takes classes, he builds the prototypes, does a Kickstarter project, very successful, starts hiring people, starts making these things, writes the book, gets interviewed like crazy. And now he's, not only is he one of the leaders in the maker movement, but he's also one of the leaders in submersible robotics. That it's like, he did that himself. He just did it. And I mean, he went from nothing. You know, he should not be a leader in the maker movement or submersibles. Now he is. So, I think that's one of my favorite stories.
That's great. What do you see as kind of a minimum entry point for people who they just have an idea, or maybe they just have an interest in making?
I think there's two things that I'll say. One thing our CEO, Mark Hatch, says sometimes in front of groups or some people, he'll say, challenge yourself to make one Christmas gift for someone on your list this year. Instead of buying it, make it. Doesn't matter if you make it at a makerspace or tech shop or what, just figure out something and just make it. And what that does is it gives you this kind of adrenaline rush that you made it, you presented it, the person loved it. It was something that you couldn't have bought, they couldn't have gotten from anyone else. And it's just this special thing that happens. And that's a good way to get some people hooked on being makers. I think a lot of people have the potential to be makers, but they need to be coaxed. You know, they need to be drawn into it. So making something for someone for Christmas is good. The other way I think that's good is just go to your local makerspace, Tech Shop, hopefully, if you have one nearby, and take a class. You know, classes are cheap. You don't have to be a member at most makerspaces to take the class. And just go there, take a class and hang out with people and, you know, see if you like the vibe. Chances are you're going to meet some really super creative, super kind people there, and you're going to get hooked. The maker movement is full of people that are non-judgmental, non-competitive. They want to help you. They don't want to shoot down your idea. Like if you take you have an idea for something, you go to work, you know, your typical workspace, and you tell your coworker about this invention you want to make, what do you think they're going to do? You know, they're going to laugh at you. You're going, that's stupid. Why would you want to do that? How are you going to ever pull that off? And that's what people get in their daily lives all the time. So you go to a makerspace and try it out with a class or whatever. Or a lot of makerspaces don't let you do this, but a tech shop, you can just come in and buy a month and try it out. There's no startup fee. There's no minimum term or any of that crap. We don't do any of that. Just try it. And you know, you're going to find that it's such a nurturing environment to let your ideas blossom. It's just crazy.
It's beautiful. How about marketing? How does marketing play out in the maker scene? I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on patterns and if you find makers come up to you and they say, look, Jim, I built this thing, but now I really don't know what to do.
Yeah, you know, it's hard. There's good things and bad things about the maker movement. One of the bad things is that there are so many projects, so much noise now, just because of the volume of things that are being done. It's hard to get above that. So if you have a really, really cool product, you can get buzz. You got to just figure out ways to get buzz. You won't get buzz if it's not cool. So it has to be cool.
Right.
But, you know, I think there's things like the origami kayak that was made at Tech Shop. It's this full-size seaworthy kayak that folds down into a pack that you can slide behind your bed in your little tiny San Francisco apartment. That's what it was designed for. He got a lot of buzz from that. Got on a lot of shows, a lot of articles, got on Shark Tank, which gave him a lot of visibility. But I think Kickstarter and Indiegogo are really great platforms to sort of point all your efforts to drive buzz from. You know, use that as the central hub and go out that way. I don't know. It's hard for us to market stuff. The reason it's hard for us to market Tech Shop as a service that's available to anyone, because everybody has ideas of things they want to make, we can't just focus. Like if we were targeting people that love cats, you know, we could go to a cat show or we could, you know, advertise in a cat magazine or go on Animal Planet or something like that. But our potential audience, and I think the potential audience for a lot of these products that people make, the market's so wide that it's hard to, you know, really penetrate at all. You end up penetrating in just a little tiny, tiny ways where you really need to get deeper in.
Right.
I don't know. I'm not a marketing expert. That's why I hire really good people at Tech Shop to do that for me.
That's good. What do you think is the biggest challenge for an individual to overcome in the makerspace?
I think self-doubt. And I mean, that sounds kind of like an odd response, I think, but that's the thing I see most often is people that had an idea for something. Every time I ask them, why didn't you do it? I didn't think it would work, or, you know, our friends, my family said it was kind of silly, you know, all these things that build up. So you have to get past that. If you think it's a good idea and it's a product thing that you would like to buy personally yourself, if someone else made it, you would buy it, then it's probably a good idea. And you should pursue it with as little effort as possible to get a viable product. You know, don't go out and spend $10,000 on a patent before you actually know if it's going to work or not. And, you know, there's kind of a transition of an order of things that you should do, but you should definitely pursue it.
Great.
I don't know. That's the biggest thing I see. That's the biggest hurdle I see people getting stuck on.
Do you have a question or a mantra that you like to ask yourself to keep you inspired and growing?
At the end of each day, I kind of ask myself, did you do something today that was important and mattered? And I'm kind of mad at myself when I have to say no. You know, no, I looked at the internet all day and kind of goofed around and, you know, was playing with this new tool that I got or whatever. And I didn't really make any impact on anyone. I like to really try to do that as much as I can.
That sounds like a window to your style of leadership. Do you ever think about your style of leadership?
Not very much, but, you know, we're definitely mission driven in this company. We really are. And, you know, we all think about that and our entire staff thinks about that when we offer a product or we deliver a service, is this something that we would actually buy? Would we actually pay our money to buy this class or this membership or these products in our retail store or, you know, whatever it is that we're offering? Even when we offer investment, we're doing our big Series B investment round right now. Even when we do that, the offer that we give, would we invest? Would we actually want to put our money into this investment? So that's really important for us to drive it from a personal point of view. And I guess, you know, I probably helped instill that in the staff because that's something that I started the company with very strongly.
What are the most exciting changes that you're following at the moment?
The most exciting changes, I think the most exciting things, the most exciting trends that I'm seeing in, well, like tools and software, I think that's my passion.
Anything that you can mention specifically?
Well, yeah. All the software is getting more and more easy to use. You know, Autodesk has a whole, it seems like every day they come out with a new application or add-on or new ability that gives you some capability that you never knew you could ever even do. They've got their the 1-2-3D series of software that's all absolutely free. It lets you model, lets you take pictures from your phone or your digital camera and you take a picture of a 3D object, and then all the pictures get stitched into a 3D model, and then you can load that up into, you know, your software and print it out on the 3D printer. And it's like just insane stuff. And I think, you know, the computer controlled stuff, the CNC stuff, laser cutters, CNC mills, 3D printers, is really an important, very, very critical aspect of the maker movement blossoming the way it has, because it allows someone without machining skills or production skills to make things that look like they were made professionally. So the important part is the important part is using the software to drive these machines. So you really have to have a good grasp on that, but becoming more and more easy all the time. You know, there's some interesting things coming out. I think there's a lot of desktop milling machines starting to come out that instead of adding up parts with a 3D printer, it's subtractive manufacturing where you're cutting away. And that's traditionally how things have been made. But it's interesting now to see something that lives right next to a MakerBot on your desk that can do subtractive while you have additive on this side, you know, subtractive on that side. And the software in the particular one that I'm using, which is called an Other Mill, they have a software package that drives it called Other Plan. And it's really amazing because you can see before you actually machine it, you know, you tell it what the material is, you tell it where it is on the bed and all this stuff, and you actually see it right on your screen, just like you do with a 3D printer program. You see where the tool is going to go, and you can actually see it preview what the cut path is. So before you actually spend all the time and cut it, you can actually see if it's going to work or not. And really super interactive. And I don't know, that kind of stuff is going to really, really boost a lot of people into wanting to become makers because it's a lot easier and a lot less scary.
Wonderful. What was that software called again?
The milling machine that I have, it's called Other Mill.
Other Mill.
That's the machine itself. And then they have the software that runs on it called Other Plan. And you can download the software for free. And I think it will operate other machines. I'm not sure besides theirs, but people can download it and like goof around with it. It's kind of cool. If you do circuit boards in Eagle, which is a circuit board design software that's also free for the basic version, you design your circuit board, save it as a circuit board, and then you can open that circuit board directly in the Other Plan software and machine out the circuit board out of copper clad, you know, PC board. But it will actually show you the circuit and all the traces and all the holes. It drills all the holes, everything. It's pretty cool.
That is cool.
Bring two-dimensional designs in from like something like AutoCAD or Adobe Illustrator or something like that in a SVG format. So you can do, like, if you wanted to make, if you have a prototype and your circuit board needs to be like an arc that goes and fits up in the handle of something or something, you can actually make that curved circuit board or machine a piece of aluminum to fit up in there or whatever you want. So it's without having to do a lot of really crazy, you know, CAD design stuff.
Right. Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up. I think a lot of folks with ideas might be intimidated by the technology. Do you have any guidance for somebody? They say, you know, I've got an idea for a widget and I'd like to start doing some kind of a computer design, but I just don't even know where to start. Do you have a recommendation for maybe one of the easier softwares that's a nice little entry point?
Yeah, what I would recommend. So I mentioned the Autodesk 123D. SketchUp is good for a lot of people. SketchUp is a free program that was originally designed by a company in Denver back, I think it was before 2000, back in the 1990s, a guy named John Backus that started that company and did it, and then sold that to Google. Google used it for and had it available, and now it's been sold to Trimble, but it's still free. And SketchUp's really insanely easy to use and learn. It's you just load it up and you're like, you drag this around and then suddenly you're building models. It's really cool. The only downside of it is it's polygonally based. So if you draw a circle for a model, it's going to be made of facets. You know, when you make that circle and you extrude it into a like a cylinder, you're going to have bands on the side of the cylinder. Whereas something like Autodesk Inventor or 123D or Fusion 360, which is also an Autodesk product, you do that circle. It's actually a mathematical representation of a circle. So there are no facets to it. When you extrude it, no matter how close you zoom in, it's still going to be smooth.
It's like a vector compared to a bitmap.
Yeah, exactly. So when you 3D print your model, a SketchUp cylinder, is the 3D model is going to have those facets in it as well. Whereas one done with a procedural mathematical representation is going to be as smooth as that 3D printer can achieve. So that's an important consideration. But I would say SketchUp's good. I would say, you know, grab it. It's free. And I would say for a little bit more sophisticated design stuff that's still really easy to use and grasp, I would say the Fusion 360 product is good. That's a free download. I think they want you to buy it after a while, but it doesn't actually expire, so you can just keep using it forever.
Okay.
Autodesk's really, really embracing the maker movement and trying to really empower people. They're not all hung up on trying to convert every person into a customer. They're really, I know Carl, the CEO, pretty well, and he's mission-driven just like we are.
Excellent. That's a good lead-in because I wanted to ask you a little bit about your vision for the future, both with Tech Shop and as a reflection on the maker movement generally.
Hmm. Wow. Well,
have fun with it.
Our vision is to have Tech Shop locations in every community across the planet. You know, we want to empower, we want everybody to have access to the tools that they need to be able to make things, to innovate, to come up with new technologies, new solutions to improve the world, to improve their own lives, you know, whatever it is that they want to do. But, you know, the sad part about it is that you can't do that unless you have the tools to be able to do that. You have to have the tools, and it's not trivial for someone to put a shop together themselves and do it. It's too much of a barricade and they won't do it. We've seen that happen up until now in human history. It's too hard to do innovation, so people don't. This maker movement is allowing people to finally do that. So I think the future is, you know, I mean, there's an analogy that I like to use. If you look back to the mid 80s, when the Macintosh first came out, 1984, there was this new thing called desktop publishing that came from the Mac. And, you know, Windows supported it as well and all that, but it was primarily on the Mac. The laser printer, the laser writer, laser printer that they put out, and things like the RIP printers so you could do film output, things like that. So think about it. At that point, you called yourself a desktop publisher if you did that stuff. Hey, I'm a desktop publisher. You went to conferences about desktop publishing, right? There were big conventions about it. There were magazines about desktop publishing that you would subscribe to. And like you would go to Fry's and there was like a whole bunch of magazines about desktop publishing. Fast forward to today, everybody has all the equipment and even way better equipment that people had back then. But nobody calls themselves a desktop publisher anymore. There's no magazines about it. There's no conferences about it. People just do it. It's just this normal thing that everybody does. And that's exactly what I want making to be, and I think it will. Right now, you're interviewing me about the maker movement, right? There's the Maker Faire. There's magazines, Make Magazine. There's magazines about making stuff. There's all these resources and stuff talking about this really new weird thing called the maker movement and makers. In 20 years from now, I don't want that to be the case. I don't want a Maker Faire to be around. I don't want Make Magazine to be around. I don't want the term maker to be around. I just want everybody to be engaged in making. And I want it just to be a normal, everyday thing. I think that will happen too. I mean, you see that in desktop publishing, like I just said. You also see that in fitness, right? 25 years ago, there were no health clubs and fitness clubs around. It's kind of hard to imagine that. You know, back when Joe Gold started the Gold's Gym down in, you know, wherever it was, whatever beach that was down in LA.
Venice, yeah.
Yeah. You know, it was only competitive bodybuilders that went there. It wasn't like everyday, it wasn't soccer moms that went in there to like do their little, you know, workout and then go pick up the kids from school. That's not what it was at all. It was hardcore. And if you went there, you were a bodybuilder. You were into fitness in a pretty severe way. Nowadays, most people have access to a health club or they have, you know, health equipment in their house. You don't call yourself a bodybuilder or a fitness freak or anything. You just exercise. And making's going to happen that way. Making's going to become mainstream in that way.
It's very exciting. Can't wait to see how that evolves. TechShop is a fascinating business model. What can you share about how the business exists and thrives?
We're thriving just by people finding out about us and, you know, engaging. Mm-hmm. I think we're the best, probably the most complete solution right now as far as makerspaces go. You know, because we've really tried to build this entire arc. People look around and say, why do you have sewing machines here? Well, if you're going to make a chair or a set of chairs for your dining room, woodworking, great. Metal for the brackets, great. Finishing for the wood, you know, to be able to spray it, sand it and all that, great. How about the cushions? You know, you got to sew the cushions. So we try to have all these arcs of different capabilities so that you're not going to run into a roadblock. I think that's part of why our business can thrive, because we're providing a pretty complete solution.
I think you guys take corporate sponsorships, right? Does that kind of amount to, okay, if there's a corporation who's also a manufacturer, then now they can work with TechShop and have a test bed and a prototyping site that has maybe materials and equipment that their lab or garage or wherever they're building doesn't have?
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I'll give you a really great example too, which is Ford Motor Company. So Ford Motor Company, you'd think that they'd have pretty good facilities for their employees to, you know, prototype and burn off steam and come up with ideas, right?
Right. Yeah, I would hope so.
They don't have that.
Not so much?
They don't have that. No. So back a few years ago, we got a call from Ford, and it was funny because my CEO got a message from the front desk at TechShop saying that Bill from Ford called. He wants you to call him back. Well, it wasn't Bill Ford. It was a guy named Bill Coughlin, who runs their global innovations division.
Wow.
All the intellectual property licensing in and out of Ford goes through Bill and his team. But Bill asked us, when are you going to build a tech shop in Detroit? Because, you know, Detroit could really use it. And he thought that Ford could really use it too for the employees as a resource for them. And we said, well, we have a top 50 cities target list, and it was number 39 on our list. You know, Detroit was.
Wow.
So he said, yeah, it's not going to happen for a while, dude. Sorry. And he said, well, what would it take to make it, you know, happen sooner? So they actually bought a whole bunch of memberships up front for their employees, huge block of memberships. And so what they do is they give the memberships out to their employees when any employee that has an idea that they want to pursue, whether it's a personal idea or one for the company, they'll give them one of these memberships and let them just go and go nuts with it. And there's been a couple of really interesting innovations that have come from that already that are going to end up on the cars in the next few years, just from people, you know. And what's interesting about it, it's not just the engineers that are getting getting these memberships is people from HR and people from other departments that have no right to be designing new technologies for Ford vehicles, but they have ideas. And it's this whole open innovation thing. A lot of companies are grabbing on to this open innovation trend. I think it started with Procter & Gamble. Their CEO said that they wanted 50% of new product ideas to come from outside of the company, meaning when customers send in ideas, instead of taking the envelope and writing, we didn't open this and sending it back, saying, la, la, we don't want to hear your ideas because we might already be doing that idea. And if we are, you're going to sue us because you're going to think that we stole your idea. There's that, that whole thing. Open innovation puts that to the side and says, your customers are your most passionate developers. They're the ones that care about your product the most, the people that actually buy your product. So why would you not listen to what they have to say about it? So open innovation can come from customers. It can come from your non-engineering staff. It can come from any source. So smart companies like Ford are embracing that open innovation trend. We're working with a lot of other companies in that area as well.
That paints a cool picture. I bet that there are some very unique communities that are aggregating around each of the tech shops. I bet they're very different. That the Detroit community of makers at the tech shop is probably very different than the one in Crystal City, Virginia.
Yeah, they definitely have their own sort of, flavor. Yeah, it's still the core. It's people that are passionate about what they're working on, and they found their new home, and they're there, and they're working on their stuff, and they're energized because of that. But you do see areas of specialization. Like in Detroit, it's definitely automotive technology. It's not necessarily people building cars, but we do have a really fantastic car shop there. We have a lift and a turntable. You can put your car on, spin it around, and look at it. And
wow,
the whole thing. It's really nice, all glassed in.
Very cool.
They do have their own flavors, but there's more common thread than you'd think.
I see. Okay, well, we've kept you a long time. I think this was great. So where should people go to learn more and to reach you?
Well, if they have a tech shop nearby their location where they live or where they work, they should definitely come by and just get a tour. We give free tours. Just go in and ask. If you have a local makerspace, go check them out and go get a tour. Go get involved. A lot of times they're looking for leadership help because they're typically more grassroots based. And if you don't have a makerspace in your area, start one. I'm not going to say it's easy. It's not. It's really hard. But it's, you can really impact people in your community in a very positive way if you can manage to pull it off.
Perfect. Well, we'll have links and notes to everything that we talked about on the show at spiralmarketing.com. Your website is techshop.com.
Yep, that's right.
And I think you're on Twitter, aren't you?
I'm on Twitter. Not super active, but I go on there sometimes. It's TechShop Jim.
Okay, well, this was awesome. Jim, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
In many ways, this episode is an inventor's story. From a creative young boy to an inventor, Jim imagined a way to literally build his dreams and a business. Philosophically, the beauty behind the movement here is that we're trying to open up an economic pathway, a meritocracy of sorts, where people are more able to elevate themselves through the power of their ideas. The message here is a call to arms for the inventor to get out of their fortress of solitude. To the creative person and the not-so-creative person, the next time a light bulb turns on and you have a great idea, see where that light takes you. Go find the equipment that you need and the community that supports you. As Dylan Thomas said, do not go gentle into that good night. Thanks for listening, folks. Cheers.